Fasten your seatbelts and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. It is a period of civil war. Rebel spaceships striking from a hidden base have won their first victory against the evil Galactic Empire. While many of us have seen Star Wars, the sequels and the prequels, Darth Vader and the Death Star, Luke Skywalker and lightsabers, sand people and Wookiees. Since it first hit the big screen in 1977, many of us have probably latched on to Star Wars books, video games, and very likely, comic books. That's what we're going to talk about this week on Roots 51. Bill Martin's in for Glenn Moberg. It's Thursday, August 30th, 2012. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. But we're not just going to limit this conversation to Star Wars because our guest can go well beyond that. He's John Jackson Miller, who's best known for his Star Wars writings, including the novel Star Wars, Knight Errant, and the Knights of the Old Republic. He's also written for the Mass Effect, Iron Man, Crimson Dynamo, and Bart Simpson comics, and the comic adaptation of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Further, he's a big comics industry historian, editing buyer's guides and other works. Maybe you've checked out his research at ComicCron.com. He's written for the Star Wars role-playing game and more, and he just happens to be from the small town of Iola. John Jackson Miller joins us from our Wausau studio. Hello, John.
Hey, Bill. How's it going?
Great, thanks. Sounds like you're living the dream.
Well, I like to joke that I've been strip mining my childhood for a living for a number of years here.
I guess so. That's one way to put it. If you want to ask John a question, 1-800-780-9742. Or post a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. Are you a comic book fan? What's your favorite and why? Are they as good as the movies? Which one would you recommend and why? Again, that number is 1-800-780-9742. So, John, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, you were 6 years old and reading Bugs Bunny and Uncle Scrooge comic books. What was it about comic books that got you hooked for your whole life?
Well, Bill, I think that really it felt like an accessible medium. It was something where you make that transition as a child from picture books to books with writing in them. And of course, back in those days, there were a lot of places for kids to actually run into comics. The big boy restaurants would give out give away comics. Every mm-hmm. newspaper had comic strips in them, and kids were considered that their part of the comics, their part of the newspaper. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of opportunities to read comics. And I, as a kid growing up, I actually, I'm a transplant here, to Iola, to the Wapaka County area. I actually started in Memphis. Getting comics back then, it was really sort of the first thing I ever collected. And, other kids' mothers, the joke is that, my mom threw my comics away. My mother was a grade school librarian, so she encouraged me to put my comic books in order.
Well, there you go. So you were exposed to this at an early age, and there you go. So now I understand you also wrote and drew your own comics, correct, when you were a kid? What were those like?
Well, that's right. These were just on notebook paper, folded over and stapled. Really almost at the same time I started reading my own comics, I was drawing my own. And one of the things that I started doing from the beginning was creating my own characters. I was not doing stories, using other people's characters, which of course is kind of ironic now, since most of the writing that I've been doing as a professional, comic book writer and author, has been licensed material using other people's characters in other sandboxes. And mm-hmm. of course, I wasn't that great of an artist, and since then I've been asked not to draw. But one of the things about having done my own comic strips and then comic books is that I learned the visual language. I learned how to tell a story using the unique tools that you have as a comics writer. I understand what the artist needs to get from the writer in terms of how to break down a story and that sort of thing. And again, it does sound unusual to have to say that you have to learn how to read comics and that we have a different way of communicating a story. But it really is something that, you know, people have to be introduced to, at an early age or, you know, if they're introduced to it later, you know, there are tricks of comics reading and comics writing, that are unique to, the medium. Comics, I think, really are an American art form, an American original, you know, alongside, you know, jazz and blues music. You know, there's something that started here. 1935 was when the first, what we understand to be comic books came out. They were just basically a way for the newspaper publishers to keep the presses running on the weekend. Sure. And they were, at that time, they were just reprints of old comic strips. It wasn't really until you get to the latter part of the 1930s and, Siegel and Shuster create Superman for DC Comics and, also Batman is created in that time and then Captain America soon after that. You know, the golden age of comics starts and, you know, comics do then become their own, part of the publishing world. And, ever since, we've had lots of ups and downs in the business, but, I'm glad that, you know, my kids are able to read comics today the same way I was able to when I was a kid.
We'll talk more about that history as we go along here. So you wrote and drew your own comics into your high school years and you had mailed these around to other people. So who were the people you mailed them to? Were they just like friends of yours or, you know, how did you get these subscribers, if you will?
Well, there was a small press, part of fandom. Comics fandom, of course, people were fans of the, professionally published comic books. But there was also a sort of a postal part of the hobby that grew up in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Mini comics, we would mail them back and forth to each other. I would advertise in publications like Comics Buyer's Guide, which, was published out of and is still published out of Iola here in Wisconsin. And of course, eventually I got to work for the publication itself. It was very low tech. It was how we, got things distributed. It was all with the photocopy machine. If I were doing it again now, I would have the advantage of the internet and I would probably be doing web comics instead of, comics on paper. That is really the way these days that, the kids, like I was, are getting out there and they're getting their work seen.
Now, my apologies for somewhat revealing your age here, but the Star Wars movies had come out when you would have been in high school, correct?
I would have been nine, I think, when the first movie came out. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, so did you ever think back then that, boy, I would love to do some work on that project?
Well, I was certainly ripping off Star Wars and all the comics I was doing myself. And the first grown-up comic book really that I ever got, age nine, was that first issue of Star Wars, by Roy Thomas and Howard Chaykin that came out from Marvel Comics. It was an adaptation of the movie and actually it was, such a big hit that it ended up, saving, the publisher Marvel Comics, that released it. That was an adaptation that actually started a couple of months before the movie came out, so it was a real risk on the part of the publisher. But for people like me, these are the days before the multiplexes. These were the days before, home video. There was no real way to experience this movie if you didn't have somebody to stand in line with you for hours and hours and hours at the movie theater, or if you didn't have either the prose adaptation that came from Del Rey, or the comics adaptation that was coming from Marvel. There really wasn't a way to experience the movie any other place, and there wasn't a way to extend the Star Wars adventure except through this material. And of course, later on, there were the action figures and all the other things that kids like me were playing with. But yes, absolutely. It was for us a way to extend the experience, and certainly, yeah, I did dream of, hey, it would be great to do Star Wars stuff myself one day.
Well, you went to college then at the University of Tennessee, and from there you got a gig as a trade magazine editor, and then after some time came to Iola. Now, I'm guessing a lot of people probably don't think of Iola, you know, little Iola in Wapaka County, only about like 1,300 people live there today, as a pocket for the comic book industry. So what's going on in Iola?
Well, there's actually a lot more to the comics industry in Wisconsin than I think people probably realize. In Iola specifically, what we've got, you know, Chet Krause founded Krause Publications there in the 1950s. He founded it basically as a vehicle to, you know, connect with other coin collectors. He started a magazine called Numismatic News. And later on, he started magazines for old cars and acquired a number of other magazines, including he acquired a, you know, what was then the number one, you know, fan magazine for comics in early 1981 or 82, which he renamed Comics Buyer's Guide. Comics Buyer's Guide was a weekly newspaper that came out, and it was sold in comic shops. And also through the mail. That is where I found out a lot more about the business. It was edited by Don and Maggie Thompson, who were, you know, really legendary figures in sort of the comics world. You know, we refer to them as the George and Martha Washington of comics fandom, because, you know, they were at the first conventions for comics in the 60s. They were also, they edited the first fanzine, one of the first fanzines for comics, you know, that came out in 1960. Mm-hmm. When I was able to get the job, actually editing the trade magazine, Comics Retailer, which was a sister publication for Comics Buyer's Guide, you know, that was just wonderful for me, because I got to learn from the Thompsons and, you know, got to be a part of the comics industry. And, you know, I ended up marrying a woman who ran the largest comic shop in Seattle a couple of years later. It really became a lifetime here in the business for me.
I guess so. Well, my name is Bill Martins, filling in for Glenn Moberg. This week on Route 51, we're talking to John Jackson Miller about the comic book industry. John, about 10 years ago, you got a phone call from Marvel, one of the big guns in the comic book publishing biz. They've got Spider-Man, X-Men, Incredible Hulk, Captain America, you know, just to name a few. What did they say? What did they want?
Well, this was a period where Marvel was, you know, bouncing back. There had been a big recession in the comics industry in the 1990s. You know, the number of titles Marvel had published had collapsed. Marvel had actually been in bankruptcy for a few years there. But as we got into the 2000s and the you know, the Spider-Man movie came out and you know, a number of things were happening with the comics industry, Marvel was ramping up again. And one of the things that they were looking to do was to start a line for new talent. And specifically, they were looking for people, you know, for the first wave of it, you know, guys who, men and women who had written extensively about comics. They were looking to find some folks who, you know, understood the comics and understood Marvel characters, but hadn't actually, you know, written comics you know, professionally before. So, you know, I was given the opportunity to pitch for this, and, you know, after getting permission from my superiors, I proposed a series which ended up being the flagship title that came out from Marvel in this epic comics line that they had. And that was called Crimson Dynamo. It was based on a Soviet era villain for the Iron Man series. And, you know, that's something that actually ties into a previous sort of side trip in my own career. Before I edited magazines, I got what I believe to be the last master's degree offered in Soviet studies in this country. I had planned to go actually, you know, out and you know, do that for a living, but then the Soviet Union collapsed on my dissertation, and I really was not able to go any further with it because everything that I was studying was mm-hmm. gone. I went into journalism, but it was very nice that I was able to later on, you know, use some of my background. What I knew about Russia and what I knew about, you know, the Cold War and everything in this series that really was my demo reel, for the comics business. And, you know, that led to a run on Iron Man itself. You know, that then, you know, opened the door for me to write other comics, you know, with, you know, Lucasfilm, Star Wars licensees, Dark Horse Comics. Mm-hmm. You know, various others, you know, ranging from The Simpsons to Mass Effect, the video game comics.
Have you ever met George Lucas?
I have not. I understand he was down at Star Wars Celebration, which I was at this past weekend. Basically he's got a whole lot of things going on in his world. I have gone to the Lucasfilm headquarters, which is out in San Francisco. That was just wonderful. That was where I got to read the script for Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And that was, of course, under lock and key, under heavy security. Because I had to read the script, a year before the movie came out. And break it down for the comics artist to develop, but that's just a wonderful place. And anybody who ever breaks into the business and has a chance to work for these folks, it's kind of like Oz out there.
Any word on how he feels about your work?
Well, I understand that he does read some of the material that comes out in what's known as the expanded universe. He's a fan of a lot of it. Mine particularly, I don't know. I will say that one of the things that is special about the Star Wars comics and novels and also video games and other cartoons and other material that's out there is that he and his staff made the decision that what happens in our stories actually happens to the characters. In the past, these licensed stories would have been considered just, interchangeable with a T-shirt or some other, licensed product. It was just a tie-in. Didn't have any bearing on what happened in the lives of the characters. This is a sea change. This has happened in the last 20 years here, and it's actually been adapted by some of the other, licenses that are out there. Treating what happens in the comics and the novels as being just as important, or being part of the world, with the movie characters, the source material. I think that's really helped us, to get a lot more fans.
We're talking with John Jackson Miller, comic books writer and researcher from Iola, about his work with Star Wars and Iron Man. We're going to get into some of his other work coming up after the break. John, you also just got back from a big Star Wars convention in Orlando, so I'm going to ask you about that as well. And if you have a favorite comic book series, give us a call and tell us about it. Why do you like comic books? How did you get into them? Or maybe you have a question for John Jackson Miller about his work. 1-800-780-9742. 1-800-780-9742. You can also leave a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. I'm Bill Martins, and for Glenn Moberg, you're listening to Route 51 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Northwind Renewable Energy in Stevens Point, adapting renewable energy and wood heat solutions to meet the needs of homes, farms, and business. Information at northwindre.com.
We're back on Route 51 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill Martin's in for Glenn Moberg this week. My guest is John Jackson Miller, the man behind several comic books, buyer's guides, and a whole lot of research. He's a native of Iola. John, we were talking before the break about some of your work with Star Wars, including the Knights of the Old Republic series. You just got back this week from Orlando, where Star Wars Celebration 6 was taking place. Now, this is a big convention, the Star Wars Celebration, that takes place every few years, not an annual thing. I take it, John, you're down there signing comic books, or what?
Well, I actually had a couple of releases out this time. I started to break into the prose side of things with my Star Wars Knight Errant novel last year. This year, I had two releases that were tied together. From Del Rey, the publishers of the novels, I have a book out that came out in July called Star Wars: Lost Tribe of the Sith, the Collected Stories, and this was a series of short stories that we had released partially online, but then I wrote some original material for that that would appear just in the collected edition. And this is in bookstores now, and this covers not the heroes of Star Wars, but a subgroup of the people known as the Sith, the villains from Star Wars, of which the Emperor and Darth Vader were part of that group. This is a series of stories that deals with a group of these evil Sith characters who crash land on a primitive planet 5,000 years before Luke Skywalker. And then somehow they survive on this world, emerge to threaten Luke and his family and friends years later. So I was signing that, and we also have spun off a comic series that I'm also writing that has just now started from Dark Horse Comics, and that's called Star Wars Lost Tribe of the Sith. Spiral is the subtitle of that series. And so I was able to sort of do double duty there and sign both, for Dark Horse and for Del Rey. And of course there were panels, events on how to write comics and what the various publishers had coming up. And it was great to see a lot of the other authors there. Timothy Zahn, Troy Denning, he's actually another Wisconsin native who writes Star Wars novels. Seeing all these folks there, James Luceno, it's a time and place for the fans to get to meet and talk with the authors and for us to all talk with each other. Then, of course, one of the great things that happens is you get to see characters that you created in real life because, there are a lot of people that dress up in costumes.
I was just going to bring that up. I've seen a few pictures from that event last weekend, and yeah, I guess it was about what I expected. Lots of people dressed up like stormtroopers, Princess Leia, and other characters. But you actually saw some people dressed up as the characters that you personally created.
Yeah, that's right. There is this group out there, an organization called the 501st. And they have spin-off groups such as the Rebel Legion and the Mandalorian Mercenaries, the Mandalorian Mercs, that particularly dress up as stormtroopers or members of the good guys or the Mandalorians or people who are dressed up like Boba Fett, the bounty hunter from Star Wars. But yeah, every so often you'll get characters that you actually introduced in your stories. We had a couple of Zane Carricks. Zane is the sort of hapless hero from our Knights of the Old Republic comic series. We had Jor-El, who is the very alien looking sidekick and sometime girlfriend of Zane's from that series. We also had a Kara Holt. Kara Holt is the very competent Jedi, teenage girl Jedi from the Star Wars Knight Errant comics and series that I've written. Getting to see these folks, the amount of work that they put in is really something. At a convention in Memphis, my hometown, a couple of years ago, some fans brought me a full-size, life-size Muppet of one of the alien characters. And, this is somebody.
Nice.
I had challenged them to come up with a costume for the character because, again, he's 3 feet tall and, I didn't figure they'd be able to come up with a real one. Here they show up with this figure that, I ended up carrying around for most of the convention and we ended up doing a reading with a puppeteer, working the character's arms and legs. I still have him in my house. He scares my daughter whenever she sees him. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, well, speaking of fans, I was talking with one of my office mates today, Chris Molina, who produces for Ad Issue with Ben Marins. He was telling me about how comic books, more so than any other medium, talking movies, books, TV shows, whatever, that comic books allow their fans to have a say in what happens, that they actually seek out input from their followers. So what kind of a role have fans played in your works? Do they tend to pitch you a lot of ideas?
They do, and I think that I would almost refer to comics as being like theater in the round, because we had a world in which comics fandom really started to get going in the 1960s and 70s, and through fanzines, and then later through the internet and message boards, and of course all the conventions, there was interplay and interaction from the fans over what you were working on and things like that. Now, I always try to, keep some perspective and understand that as the writer, I need to give people the story, as one of my editors says, give people the story they need to read, not necessarily the story that they want to read. This is not something where, you're taking requests. You're a writer, not the disc jockey. Because otherwise you would just be giving people the same stories over and over again. And not taking them to, some places that they might not necessarily have wanted to go. But, we do certainly, respond to feedback. And one of the things particularly that in the Star Wars world, because we have this shared universe that we're in and everything counts in all of these countless comic books and games and, and cartoons and novels that have come out, you know, the details are actually relevant. And so, you know, every so often, you know, if we get something wrong, if something's placed on the wrong planet, or if we've you know, referred to something that you know is not known about in the universe in our part of the time frame yet, you know, the fans will let us know that, and you know, we want things to work just as much as they do, so we will usually you know, come back in and you know, make some sort of a correction or write a way around it later on. You know, I liken sort of what we do in that regard to, you know, being a pastry chef. Where you eat your mistakes. If something you've published turns out not to actually jive with, you know, the continuity that's out there, I use that as an opportunity to come up with you know, a story springboard usually, and you know, explain, well, okay, yes, you know, that thing that you saw back there didn't look like something in a previous book, but here's why, and you know, there's a story behind it. So yeah, I mean, what we do is a lot more than just connecting the dots and you know, tying things together. And we try to make every comic book, you know, be approachable, because every comic book is somebody's first. But even so, you know, we also want to respect the past, and you know, we understand that people have put a lot of time and effort into what they're collecting, and we want to respect that.
We're talking with Iola comic book writer and researcher John Jackson Miller and some of his works. Coming up, we're going to shift more to the research side of the spectrum. You might be surprised to find out just how popular comics are today. The numbers are wow. So we'll get into that. And if you've got a question or comment for John Jackson Miller, 1-800-780-9742. Are you a comic book collector? Do you remember swinging by the comic book store when you were a kid? What are your favorites today and why? 1-800-780-9742, or leave a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. I'm Bill Martins, and for Glenn Moberg, you're listening to Route 51 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
Little bit of the Indiana Jones soundtrack for you there. Bill Martins here on Route 51 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glenn Moberg's got the week off. He'll be back next week. We're talking with Iola's John Jackson Miller, who wrote the comic adaptation of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. John is best known for his Star Wars writings, including the novels Star Wars, Knight Errant, and The Knights of the Old Republic. He's also written for the Mass Effect, Iron Man, Crimson Dynamo, and Bart Simpson comics. Earlier, John, we were talking about some of the series you were working on. I wanted to ask you about Indiana Jones. Again, you did the comic version of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. You're a big Indiana Jones fan, I take it?
Oh, yeah, very definitely. You know, I think it's one of the things, you know, I started writing my own, you know, comics and novels. As I said, I always try to use my own characters. But I remember when Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came out, 1984, I remember I started working on one of my own attempts at a novel back then. And again, it was a thinly veiled Indiana Jones. I think, you know, I'm a history buff. I love the fact that, you know, they're able to draw on, you know, some of these real life things and then sort of transform them into, you know, fantasy, high adventure things. And you know, that sort of Saturday morning serial aesthetic that's out there, you know, it's common to Star Wars as well, but you know, it's more Earth-based. And so it was really a kick to get to work on that project.
So how did that project happen? Did the publisher just call you up and say, hey, we want to publish a comic book series, will you help us out? Or how did that all come to fruition?
Well, my publishers at Dark Horse on Star Wars, they had had the Indiana Jones license for a number of years. There hadn't been a movie out for a long time, though. And I actually started begging to write that adaptation 2 or 3 years earlier. again, it was one of those things where, you know, when we were reading the script to begin working on, you know, the adaptation, you know, they had just started principal shooting out in Hawaii at that time. And so, you know, in the early pages of that comics adaptation, we didn't even really know what a number of things were going to look like. We had some production drawings, but there was no actual photography to look at. And, you know, that ends up being something like an 88-page comic story. And I think one of the fun things is that as you flip through the story as you go along, I think things start looking a little bit more and more and more like what actually happens in the movie, because they were much further along, with the production of the film at that point. But yeah, that was definitely fun. I remember when we saw that movie in the theater, it was, kind of a personal double bill, because earlier that morning we had watched the Iron Man movie that Marvel had released. And they had drawn a number of elements, including one of the characters that I had created during my year on Iron Man for that movie. And again, it was just one of those little things that only I knew about and nobody else in the theater knew about it. But it was a lot of fun because, there we were in the theater and we'd had sort of that little brush with both of those movies.
Yeah. Well, one thing we haven't talked about yet with comic books are the illustrations. Now, you said you're a writer, not an artist, but how closely do you work with the artist? I mean, do you write the script and maybe draft a rough sketch of or something of what you want the scene to look like, or do you give him or her just, total freedom here?
Well, it used to be that all, comics production was in New York City, and, your writers and your artists would be in the same room. Since, real estate got so expensive and since, Federal Express came along and since computers came along, so that we could actually digitize the art and send it back and forth, things have gotten very decentralized. My comic book editors on Star Wars, for example, they're in Portland, Oregon. My artist on the current Lost Tribe of the Sith comic series, he's in Italy. We also have, a letterer, Michael Attia, who is in a different part of the country. Same thing for the colorist, Michael Attia. The guy that puts the letters on the page is Michael Heisler. He's also in a different part of the country. And so we end up sending these files back and forth. What I do is I write the comics in full script format. That way it's very much like a movie script. That allows the people at Lucasfilm to, take a look at everything that we've got, make sure that it's representative of the brand, make sure that it's, syncs up well with, what has been established in the Star Wars universe. And then what we do is, we put it all together. And, the amount of time from actually writing a comics, plot line to actually getting the book out, can be, 9 months to a year. It's one of those things where, they're released monthly as individual issues. They're also released now digitally on Dark Horse's digital platform. And then once the books are actually, once a completed story is out there, we release them in a trade paperback or graphic novel edition. This is a collection of the individual stories with a spine on the outside. This is what you will find in your Barnes & Noble or your local bookstore. It's almost like the home video release of the comic books.
Gotcha. People who don't follow the comics industry may not be aware of just how big this is. Now, you've done a lot of research into comic book sales. People absolutely love this stuff. Some estimates put comic book sales last year at more than $660 million. Why do we go bonkers for comics?
Well, I think that, comics have had some ups and downs over the last 75 years. One of the things we say is that comics have nearly died three times, but we have always invented a way, to come out of it and, to.
Like a superhero.
Yeah, exactly. It's a brush with death. We've always invented a way to come out of it. And, I think that, there are a few things. Comic books, are actually, one of the healthiest parts of the magazine industry, in part because we're the magazines that people save. People get done reading a Time magazine, a Newsweek or something like that. It goes in the recycle bin. But people save the comics because they have this sense that they're literature. They have this sense that it's, it's telling a story. They don't want to throw it away. They also have this sense, I believe, that, they're collectible. And indeed, a lot of comics are, valuable in and of themselves as collectibles. Now, I generally caution people, as somebody who used to write price guides for a living, that, you know, the comics that hold, you know, collectible value are usually the ones from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, back when people didn't know to save them as well, and back when they were printed on much poorer paper, and so they you know, had to be, you know, cared for a lot better, otherwise they didn't stay in great shape.
So what kind of value are you talking that those particular comic books would have today if they're in mint condition?
Well, it depends on what it is, really. I mean, the first appearance of Superman in Action Comics has been sold a couple of times now for over $1 million.
Wow.
Those first issues of Star Wars from 1977 when they came out. You know, it depends on which version it is, because there's several versions of those comics. There is a particular version of that issue that came out where, you know, they did a limited press run of a certain number of issues with a variant cover price, and those only appeared in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and several other places that collectors have found. You know, that's, if it's in great shape, that's a good $5,000 comic book if you're looking for it. You know, we do caution, though, that, you know, so many of these things are printed and they're all saved now that really, you know, you cannot fund your college education with them if you just bought a stack a couple of weeks ago. And in fact, that's how we got into, I think, a problem in the early 90s, because we had a speculator boom where people were buying thousands of copies of individual comics thinking that they could flip them a couple of years later or a couple of months later. But, you know, since then, what we've gotten a lot smarter about what supply and demand are in this business. eBay has played a really important role because people see, you know, how scarce something is. And then you have websites like my website at comicron.com, where I have, you know, when the sales figures come out every month, I make estimates based on what I know about what's out there. How many copies are out there in print, you know, in the comic shops in North America? And then I've been doing research going backwards, you know, back to as far as the 30s, in terms of talking about, you know, how many copies originally existed of some of these things, and, you know, giving people sort of a sense of whether they're scarce or not. But again, you know, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, it all does go back, though, to, you know, comics are more than just the magazines. They have a dual existence as both literature and as a collectible.
Do people trade comic books like they do, you know, baseball and football cards?
Well, I certainly used to as a kid, you know, you will see people at conventions that that are making deals for comics. You know, I think really the main vehicle right now for getting comics into people's hands, and it has been really since the 1970s, is the comic book store. You know, we have several thousand comic book stores in North America that are really, you know, we talked about, you know, the dollar value of comics in the industry. You know, the majority of the money is still coming from the comic shops that are serving, you know, your regular, you know, fans that are coming in for every, you know, comics every single week. And of course, we also have comics that are now being sold in these graphic novel forms in the bookstores of the country as well. I think that people do, they will trade comics and they certainly buy and sell them.
You know, it seems like there's been an increase in the number of superhero movies lately. Captain America came out not too long ago. Spider-Man's out there. Batman. How big a source are comics for the big screen, or is the big screen inspiration or for comics, or, you know, does it work both ways? What's up?
Well, I think to a great degree what happened is when digital technology advanced to the point where, you know, we could actually, you know, have superheroes on screen and not have them look silly. You know, there were a number of superhero movies in the 70s, 80s, 90s before digital technology came out, and some of them are well regarded and some of them are pretty good. You know, the original Superman movies with Christopher Reeve, the first two, you know, people really like. The first two Batman movies done by Tim Burton. But you know, one of the tricks with this sort of thing is they were limited to what they were able to depict on screen by what the technology was. And, you know, there were a number of films that came out or actually didn't even come out. There was a Captain America movie in 1990, I think, that went direct to video. You know, there was a Fantastic Four movie that never was released because it just looked too embarrassing and they didn't want to put it out there. But once you get to the late 90s and the early 2000s, we're able to actually put up on the screen just about anything that we can imagine in the comics. And that really does open the floodgates. You also have something which happens with Marvel where they get the rights to a lot of their movie characters again, or a lot of their comics characters again. They had been spread out across a lot of different studios. Once Marvel, which is now owned by Disney, got them together, that allowed them to do things like the Avengers series of movies where, you have the individual Thor movie, the individual Iron Man movies, the individual Captain America movies, the individual Hulk movie. But then they had those tags at the end of the movie where they were able to tease, the Avengers movie that was coming up. And, of course, now we have this phenomenon of putting a comic book movie out there and having it make $1 billion. As it did mm-hmm. this year. And then, of course, DC had the Batman, Dark Knight Rises movie, which came out. So, I think that it's not all comics are about superheroes, and not all comic book movies are about superheroes. We're increasingly, becoming a source for different kinds of stories. The real big news this year, of course, is the Walking Dead TV series. It's a horror series about zombie characters. That springs from an Image Comics series by the same name, and that's a case where actually the movie, or rather the TV series, is helping build the audience for the comic series at the same time. Walking Dead, the 100th issue of that just came out in July. And that set the one-month record for the 21st century for number of copies ordered by comic shops.
Wow. I got to tell you something, John. I did not see any Star Wars until just this past Monday.
How did you like it?
it was all right, to be perfectly honest with you. I couldn't quite understand the whole, why this caught on the way it did. But for its time, the special effects were very cool. I'll admit that.
Well, I think
the funny thing...
Go ahead. I was going to say, I think I can explain why it was such a big deal when it came out. The 70s were rough in pop culture mm-hmm. and in real life. And the science fiction movies that had come out before Star Wars, they were very downbeat. You had Logan's Run, where everybody dies at 30. You have Soylent Green, and I'm not going to give away the ending of Soylent Green because everybody does. You had Silent Running, which is Bruce Dern trying to save the last forest on Earth from destruction. You had all the Planet of the Apes movies, which are post-apocalyptic by definition, and then here you come with Star Wars, and it's very much. Technological advances aside, and there were many that they had in that film. It was very much it was upbeat. The characters were throwbacks to an earlier age. The good guy wore white, the bad guy wore black. Darth Vader versus Luke Skywalker. I think it really was a transformational film, not just for how movies were marketed and released afterward, but I think it was also just it was something that really hit the spirit of the times. And I do believe that one of the reasons that George Lucas wanted to do the prequel movies that came out in 1999 through 2005 was to get another generation of kids like me an on-ramp into the Star Wars world so that we would see it in our generation again.
Well, we only have a few minutes left here, so I think what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break right now. And when we come back, let's talk a little bit about where all of this is going in the future. We'll take a look ahead. We talked a little bit about some of the digital media that's out there, and we'll see what else John is working on these days. So if you want to get in, we could probably make that work if you pick up the phone and dial now. That number is 800-780-9742. 1-800-780-9742. And don't forget about the Route 51 Facebook page. This is Route 51 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, building the local economy and strengthening the community by making local business everybody's business. More about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
Learn to know the dark side of the Force, and you will achieve a power greater than any Jedi.
Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. We're down to our last few minutes here on Route 51. Bill Martin's in for Glenn Moberg. We're talking with comic books writer and researcher John Jackson Miller of Iola. John, you wrote Star Wars Lost Tribe of the Sith as an e-book. So you'd read this on your Kindle or Nook or whatever. It's a relatively new format. Is this pretty much where comic books are headed these days?
Well, it's one of those things where for a number of years it was... Getting comic books to look good on the computer screen took a long time. It really was, you know, for people who had been diehards and who had certainly, you know, looked at the, you know, the quality of printing that had improved to such a great degree. You know, what was showing up on the computer screen was really no comparison, no replacement for the individual comic book. And I think one of the things that happened to sort of help things along is with the release of the iPad, suddenly the screen was the right shape for the comic book page. A number of delivery systems, developed, made it possible, I think, for, comics to be read online, and to make that an option. Now, one of the things that people have been, wringing their hands over is whether or not, digital would do to, comics, what digital right. has done to, say, music or to a different mm-hmm. degree to prose fiction. And I think that, those fears are really at this point, I think now unfounded. I think this year, we're going to end up doing, north of $700 million in terms of individual comic book sales, comic books plus graphic novels, everything print together, and that's across all different places that we're selling them in North America, and digital, that figure has doubled, and this year it's going to more than double the dollars there, but it's still going to be in the realm of $70-80 million probably. Wow. And that's good. The fact that comics are up 20% this year and digital is also going up. Yeah, that tells me that one is not pirating from the other. And certainly, mm-hmm. I think the true collectors are definitely always going to be interested in having the physical version, the thing that reminds them of the experience of reading. I think, for example, with that prose book, that prose story, Lost Tribe of the Sith, yes, we actually did release the individual short stories online over the course of several years. But the number one question that people had was, when does the physical book come out? This is a book which has now gone to a third printing after just a couple of weeks out on the stands. I think that there will always be a market for the physical books. I really look at it as, we're offering people an option. We're offering people an additional format, an additional way to get the material.
Hey, John, we just got a little bit of time left. I wanted to make sure I asked you about the sci-fi novel you're working on. What's the story behind that?
Well, I've been working in licensed fiction for so long, and I really needed to, at this point in my career, start working on something that I would own. I have a couple of projects going. There is a novel that I'm working on, which it's set on Earth. It is science fiction, but it also has political thriller elements. Which sort of throws back to my old Iron Man work. I'm trying to get that to a point on my schedule where I can spend more time on that. I have my own series of short stories that I'm also going to be releasing as well. I have an original short story which released earlier this year in the Bane Books collection called Armored. I'm trying to sort of achieve balance in the force with my own work at the same time. I definitely am going to continue working on licensed fiction, and I'm gonna be doing my own stuff as well. And I'm going to be doing some things that I think people may not, have expected from me, given the things I've done in the past. As I say, I have a couple of, I have Star Wars comics coming out in for the rest of the year, but I also have a couple of Simpsons comics coming out.
And, I was going to say, Bart Simpson's suing the court industry? Comics industry?
Yes. Bart Simpson is suing the comics industry. He's going to try to make sure that all the publishers of every comic book that have ever come out honor all of those coupons in the back of the comics for Sea Monkeys or whatever else happened to be in there, because if they didn't save if they didn't have an expiration date on them, Bart's gotten himself a lawyer and he's going to try to do something there. That sort of work is just a lot of fun. It's made me a celebrity with my kids. They like Star Wars, but they the Simpsons are really speaking directly to them in their world.
Less than a minute left. Any advice you have on people following their passions like you have?
Yeah, I do. I really think that what you need to do is just write for publication. Don't just write things that never are read by other people. The internet makes it possible for you to blog or do your own self-published fiction that you put out on Kindle. And I do have a number of tips, I guess. I've on my website farawaypress.com, which I've had out there for a number of years. I've got a behind the scenes page on every single comic book and novel and everything that I've ever done. And people can kind of follow, the path of production for some of these things, how we got some of the ideas. I don't know if anybody else can replicate exactly the way the path I took into this, but, I think there's some things out there they may be able to use.
All right. John Jackson Miller, thanks for joining us today. A lot of fun. John Jackson Miller is a big writer of comic books and a pretty serious comics researcher and historian and a proud resident of Iola. I'm Bill Martin, signing off from the WPR Ideas Network studio in Madison. By the way, if you want to listen to this hour, wpr.org/route51. May the force be with you.